You are listening to a sermon by Tim C., recorded on Sunday, March 1st, 2015, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Hi, and thanks for having me back and letting me speak on Revelation. There's not a lot of churches that would let me do that. Exactly. Many map makers, before the days in which humans had basically finished mapping the planet, would write, "Here be dragons," on the blank spots, waiting for a day when an explorer would go and find out what was there. This is a pretty good parallel for the way Revelation works. Not only are there dragons in Revelation, but there are plenty of blank spots. After all, Revelation is one of the most esoteric books of the Bible. Famously, Calvin never managed to write a commentary on it, and Luther wanted to get rid of it along with James. Given all the confusion it has caused and all the trouble it has caused, it's sometimes hard to imagine that anyone wanted this book in the Bible in the first place. I must admit that it's far easier to ignore it. And this is what most people do. They push it into some dark corner so they don't have to deal with it. Popularly, this happens in two ways. They either push it into the past or they push it into the future. Many scholars will push Revelation into the past by saying it only refers to events in the first century. And many lay people will push it into the future, seeing that Revelation plots kind of the end of the world and how we might live in it. In many ways, both of these approaches makes Revelation safe. If it only refers to the past, then it has no claim on my life. If it only refers to the future, then it also has no claim on my life. If in either of these cases, I might need to stock up on survival rations, but I don't need to be more like Jesus. At the end of the day, though, Revelation is in our Bible. At a very early point, the church affirmed that Revelation was fully orthodox, and moreover, very important to understanding the life and work of Jesus. They affirmed that it was fully inspired, and they affirmed that it was a safeguard against heresy, which is really ironic, given what people have done with it since. Most of all, though, they affirm that this strange, dark book at the end of the Bible would teach us how to live and follow Jesus in our lives now. It's just not always immediately clear how this is the case, because of the kind of writing that Revelation is. I typically try not to pull the Greek card too often, but this is one of the places where it matters. Revelation is an apocalypse, which does not mean that it talks about the end of the world. What it means is that it's an unveiling and uncovering of a secret that was once held but is now shown to us. To reuse the analogy of map-making, an apocalypse is like having a far-off explorer return to tell us what's in a far-off land. It just so happens that the author of Revelation, John, isn't telling us about something far off, but about something around us now. The only way about us to see. The best example of this comes from the Old Testament story of Elisha. In a story from 2 Kings chapter 6, Syria and Israel are at war. And because of all the help that the prophet Elisha is giving to Israel, the Syrian king decided to send a small army to assassinate Elisha. When Elisha's servant sees the army surrounding the city walls, he becomes very afraid. But Elisha isn't. Elisha's strangely calm, even though it looks like he's about to die. Because Elisha sees something that the servant doesn't. And so, Elijah prays, "Open his eyes, Lord, so that he may see." Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around. As it turns out, it really didn't matter that the Syrian army had the city surrounded. Elisha has Yahweh's army on his side. It's just that the serpent didn't see it. Revelation also works this way. It wants to show us the world as it really is, if only we have eyes to see it. More specifically, John wants to show us a world at war, for he sees the earth itself as the battlefield between God and between Satan, and it is up to us which side we choose to join. John begins showing us this war by introducing us to his side, which is the church. The church is described in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, and it's described with the language of the military. This is particularly seen in that the language of conquering is a prominent theme in all the seven letters. And in each of the seven letters, there's a general patterning after a Roman harangue, which is a military speech that generals would give prior to the start of the battle. These speeches would encourage the troops to fight well, promise great rewards for victory, and with the threat of punishment for failure. Each of these seven letters in Revelation chapter 2 and 3 follow this basic pattern. And so the seven letters to the seven churches, I would argue, are equivalent to seven military orders. And it's important to note that there are seven of them. Seven is characteristically used in the Bible to represent fullness or perfection. Therefore, by writing to seven churches, John is not just writing to the seven churches of Asia Minor. He is writing to the church of all places and all times. The church, throughout its history, is meant to be an army. It's just not a very good army. If we look at the church throughout history and through to the present day, it's pretty clear that the church is full of people who waver in their faith. It's full of people who teach falsely. It's full of people who make pretty bad choices. And it's full of people who would rather follow their culture than follow God. The church, from its beginning, is full of murderers and thieves and liars. It's not an army I think I would choose. Nevertheless, John sees that the church is an army, even if it's a pretty bad army. It's especially bad if you compare it to the army it's fighting against. In Revelation, God is not the only one with an army. Satan has one as well. And unlike the church, Satan's army is mighty. John describes it as a dragon with seven heads, which are seven hills. This is a fairly clear allusion to Rome, which is a city that sits on seven hills. Rome, with its self-deifying idolatry, with its decadence, and its economic and military imperialism, and its complete willingness to shed blood to preserve its own power. In all these ways and more, Rome could not be more dissimilar to the church. Rome is a massive empire spanning the entire Mediterranean Empire. The church is small and scattered. Rome is wealthy and powerful. The church is poor and weak. Rome has several legions of highly trained soldiers at its command. The church has some well-meaning slaves. Rome has the glorious Emperor Domitian, the son of Zeus, worshipped throughout the empire. The church has the peasant rabbi Jesus, the son of Yahweh, who's worshipped in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is also in the middle of nowhere. If I've been picking a side at this time, I'm pretty sure I've gone with Rome. Mighty, unstoppable Rome. But this is where John's vision comes in. This is why we need the secret to be unveiled. John has been to heaven, and looking down from heaven, the church looks very different than it does on earth. While on earth, Rome might look unstoppable, and while on earth, the church might look like it's weak and suffering, and all around unfaithful and unwell. From heaven, John sees that the church is victorious. After all, it's not merely the strength of an army that wins wars, but the brilliance of its commander. And it is this idea that is central to the book of Revelation. While the church might be the army that carries forth God's war on earth, It is in fact the resurrection of Jesus Christ that is the decisive victory that allows the war against death and against Satan to be won. The resurrection is the D-Day invasion, the dropping of nukes on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is the beginning of the end. This picture becomes pretty clear in chapters 4 and 5, when we meet the one who leads the army. As it says, "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals.' Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing at the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. The lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth." This is quite a startling verse, for John is equating the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, with the lamb looking as though it had been slain. A lion is, of course, a very powerful image, the top predator in its environment. Moreover, the Lion of the tribe of Judah is a military title, and the Root of David is a messianic title. What John hears about from this angel is an image of power. But that's not what John actually sees. Rather, John sees an image of a lamb looking as though it had been slain. This is the opposite image. It's an image of weakness, of humility. I'm not sure anyone has ever been afraid of a lamb, especially a slain one. But if we look at this lamb has seven horns and seven eyes. Seven horns, seven being the number of completion, and horns meaning power, generally, is a symbol of omnipotence, and seven eyes is a symbol of omniscience. This is a clear allusion to Christ and his work on the cross, the meaning of which is this. The crucifixion was not the defeat it looked like. Rather, the crucifixion and the resurrection are in fact the very means by which Christ is victorious. And it is this paradoxical battle plan that will characterize the army. This is made clear by the image of the war in heaven that we see in chapter 12. There is a war in heaven between God and Satan, which Satan pretty quickly loses. But if you look at the end of the passage, we see that Satan being sent to earth only intensifies his wrath. The war on earth only intensifies. And if we look through chapters 13 and 19, we see that what this means for the church is that the church is increasingly martyred. The church might be an army, but every time they show up, all that happens is that they die. All the church can do is testify to the lordship of Christ and to die a martyr's death. On earth, it doesn't look like the dragon will stop. On earth, it doesn't look like Rome can be stopped. But while the church is called to fight, it never actually joins the battle. For we see this increasing pattern of martyrdom before we come to the anticlimax of the story. For this is what John shows us in Revelation chapter 19. "Then the angel said to me, 'Write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb.' And he added, 'These are the true words of God.' Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to wage war against the rider on the horse, who is Christ, and his army. But the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who had performed the signs on its behalf. With these signs he had deluded those who had received the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. The two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur. The rest were killed with the sword coming out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh." Revelation, for all the excitement that it breeds in our popular culture, is really anticlimactic. My professors like to call it non-mageddon, because while the church is this army that stands on Zion, the church is this mighty and glorious army, they show up, and then Jesus wins. they never actually fight anybody. All they do is show up and die and give testimony to the Lordship of Christ, and that is their victory. And with the end of the war in Revelation 19, we find the world changed. No longer is it under the heel of Satan, but rather the world is transformed into a temple, which is pictured in Revelation 21 and 22. The New Jerusalem, for example, is presented as a perfect cube, which is patterned after the Holy of Holies in Solomon's temple. But whereas the old temple symbolized the fact that God was present in Jerusalem, this new temple and this new Holy of Holies in Revelation is so big that the earth itself is now the temple of God. This doesn't just mean that God is worshipped there, for the temple is more than a place of worship. The temple is a place where all is right in the world, where there's shalom and harmony and peace, where God and humanity and creation are all in right relationship with each other. It is, in effect, the Garden of Eden expanded. For if we look at this vision in Revelation 21 and 22, we find a lot of familiar elements. There's a river of life flowing from the center of the city. There's trees of life on either side. And God is once again with his people. All this imagery is taken from the Garden of Eden and from the goodness that God once instilled into the world. It's just that now, more than being just a garden, the goodness that God always intended has come to fill the entire earth. But in Revelation 22, verse 6, we're ripped out of this vision of heaven and cast back down to earth. We've been given this beautiful picture of what could be, what should be, a life without pain, without sorrow, and with all the peace and justice that we could ever dream of. But John doesn't just leave us there, as though this were something we would fly off to when we die. But he shifts us back to the earthly perspective to remind us of where we are. We can very clearly see that the new heaven and the new earth aren't around us. There's still war, there's still famine, and there's still strife. And so John, by bringing us back to earth, invites us to participate in bringing this about. And he invites us to join the army, to participate in Christ's war against death and against Satan, and against all who would follow Satan. In many ways, though, this sounds like a pipe dream. How does trying to follow Jesus matter? How could it possibly change anything? Does it even matter that we meet here on a Sunday? How will that take on the warlords? How will that take on poverty or hunger or any of another million problems in the world? And how do our weapons even work? All Christ has given us are the weapons of discipleship, of testimony, and of self-sacrifice. These are not the weapons that normally win wars. These are not the weapons of the world. And to the world, they're largely useless. But it is important to remember that in the end, we are here and the Romans are not. We who follow a crucified God and not the mighty Zeus. We who follow a peasant rabbi and not the powerful and glorious Caesar. We did not look to the shining and eternal city of Rome, but to Bethlehem, a small town in a backwater province in the middle of nowhere. We Christians, as sinful and faithless and troublesome as we are here. And the Romans, for all their wealth and might and power, are not. And we Christians have changed the world for the better. But John is not merely looking at Rome, but all who would follow Rome and be like Rome in pursuing the things of Satan. After all, if we look through history, it's easy to see that evil neither began nor ended with the Roman Empire. The 20th century attests well to this. The history of mankind is the history of empire and of war. and there are so many forces that are so much more powerful than we could ever hope to be or to face. In the face of exploitive capitalism, in the face of oppressive governments, and of human trafficking in the millions, who can stand? How can we, who are so small, so weak, and so faithless, make any difference? And I think John's answer would still be the same, that we make a difference by following Christ in the small ways. We make a difference by being a faithful church. Because by being the church, by following Christ, we are making war against the evil in the world. And in the end, the resurrection will vindicate us as victorious. After all, John's vision sees that we are but soldiers in this war. We are not its commander. That's God's duty. As such, we do not see the whole of the battlefield spanning throughout time and throughout space. All we have is what is before us. And it does make a difference, for the way in which we worship God stands against so much of our culture and so much of the evil in our world. When we choose to go to church, for example, we acknowledge that our nation is not the highest authority in the land, but we submit ourselves to someone higher. When we choose to rest on the Sabbath, we are fighting against the culture that very wrongly insists that work and wealth are all that define life. When we choose to open up our homes and our lives, we are fighting against the idea that the individual is the most important thing. When we choose to follow Christ, we will find ourselves transformed, and in doing so, begin to transform the world. This, after all, is the central paradox of the cross. It is not the strong who win, but the weak. It is not the powerful, but the lowly. It is not the proud, but the humble. Christ showed us this in his crucifixion and his resurrection. And if we follow him in self-sacrifice and in testimony, we too shall wield that same power for the transformation of the world. Amen.